But I kind of like the thought of her growing up in a country where people occasionally have no choice but to focus on something more crucial than dick replacement cars and Paris Hilton. Jackie said, with a wicked little grin pulling at the corner of her mouth. Do you know who you sound like? Shay. Sweet jumpin', Jesus! If I thought that was true, I'd blow my brains out. She gave me a long, suffering look. I know what's wrong with you, she informed me. You got a bad pint last night, and your bowels are in tatters. That does always put fellas in a mood. Am I right? My phone rang again. Kevin. I said, for fuck's sake! More viciously than I meant to. Giving him the number had made sense at the time, but give my family an inch, and they'll move into your house and start redecorating. I couldn't even turn the thing off. Not with people out there who could need me any time. If bloody Kev is always this bad at taking hints, no wonder he doesn't have a girlfriend. Jackie gave my arm a soothing pat. Don't mind him. You just let it ring there. I'll ask him tonight, was it anything important? No, thanks. I'd say he just wants to know when yous can meet up again. I don't know how to get this through to you, Jackie. I do not give a tinker's damn what Kevin wants. Although if it turns out you're right and he wants to know if we'll meet up, you can tell him this from me. With love and kisses, never. Okay? Ah, Francis, stop. You know you don't mean that. I do. Believe me, Jackie, I do. He's your brother, and, as far as I can tell, he's a very nice guy, whom I'm sure is loved by all his wide circle of friends and acquaintances. But I'm not one of them. My only connection to Kevin was an accident of nature that tossed us into the same house for a few years. Now that we don't live there anymore, he's nothing to do with me any more than that guy on the bench over there. The same goes for Carmel, and the same goes for Shay, and the same very definitely goes for Ma and Da. We don't know each other. We have exactly fuck all in common, and I can't see any reason on God's green earth why we would want to meet for tea and cookies. Jackie said, "Come on to yourself, would you ever? You know well it's not that simple." The phone rang again. "Yeah," I said, "it is." She poked at leftover leaves with a toe and waited for the phone to shriek itself into silence. Then she said, "Yesterday you said you blamed us for Rosie walking out on you." I took a long breath and lightened my voice. "I'm hardly going to blame you, chicken. You were barely out of diapers." "Is that why you don't mind seeing me?" I said, "I didn't think you'd ever remember that night." "I asked Carmel about it yesterday, after. I remember bits only. All the times get mixed up together, you know yourself." I said, "Not that time. That one's clear as crystal." It was coming up to 3 a.m. by the time my mate Wiggy finished moonlighting at the nightclub and showed up at the car park to give me my few bob and take over the rest of his shift. I walked home through the last raucous, staggering dregs of Saturday night, whistling softly to myself and dreaming about tomorrow and pitying every man who wasn't me. When I turned the corner into Faithful Place, I was walking on air. I knew straight away, in my armpits, that something had happened. Half the windows on the street, including ours, were blazing with light. If you stood still at the top of the road and listened, you could hear the voices buzzing away behind them, wound tight and giddy with excitement. The door of our flat was scored with brand new dents and scuff marks. In the front room, there was a kitchen chair upside down against the wall, legs splayed and splintered. Carmel was on her knees on the floor, wearing her coat over a faded flowery nightie, sweeping up broken china with a dustpan and brush. Her hands were shaking so hard that she kept dropping bits. Ma was planted in one corner of the sofa, breathing in heaves and dabbing at a split lip with a wet face cloth. Jackie was curled up in the other, with her thumb in her mouth and her blankie wrapped around her. Kevin was in the armchair, biting his nails and staring at nothing. Shay was leaning against the wall, shifting from foot to foot, with his hands dug deep into his pockets. His eyes had wild white rings around them, like a cornered animal's, and his nostrils flared when he breathed. He was getting a beauty of a black eye. From the kitchen, I could hear the sound of my dad getting sick, in great rasping shouts into the sink. I said, "What happened?" They all jumped a mile. Five pairs of eyes turned towards me, enormous and unblinking, with no expression at all. Carmel had been crying. Shay said, "You've got great timing." Nobody else said a word. After a while, I took the dustpan and brush out of Carmel's hands, guided her gently onto the sofa between Ma and Jackie, and started sweeping up. A long time after that, the noises from the kitchen changed to snores. Shay went in quietly and came out with the sharp knives. None of us went to bed that night. Someone had thrown my dad an elixir of his own that week. 4 days plastering work, no need to tell the dole. He had taken the extra to the pub and treated himself to all the gin he could hold. Gin makes my da sorry for himself. Feeling sorry for himself makes my da mean. He had staggered back to the place and done his little number in front of the Daly's house, roaring for Matt Daly to come out and fight. Only this time he had taken it that step further. He had started hurling himself against the door. When that got him nowhere except into a heap on the steps, he had pulled off his shoe and started throwing it at the Daly's window. This was where Ma and Shay had got there and started trying to drag him inside. Usually, Da coped relatively well with the news that his evening was over, but that night he had plenty of fuel left in the tank. The rest of the road, including Kevin and Jackie, had watched from their windows while he called Ma a dried-up old cunt, and Shay a worthless little faggot, and Carmel, when she went out to help, a dirty whore. Ma had called him a waster and an animal and prayed he would die roaring in rotten hell. Da had told all three of them to get their hands off him, or when they went to sleep that night he would slit their throats. In the meantime, he had done his level best to beat seven shades of shite out of them. None of this was new. The difference was that, before, he had always kept it indoors. Losing that boundary felt like losing your brakes doing 80. Carmel said in a small, flat, final voice, "He's getting worse." No one looked at her. Kevin and Jackie had screamed at the window for Dad to stop. Shay had screamed at them to get back inside. Ma had screamed at them that this was all their fault for driving their dad to drink. Da had screamed at them just to wait till he got up there. Finally, someone, and the Harrison sisters were the only ones on the road who had a phone, had called the guards. That was a no-no, right up there with giving heroin to small children or swearing in front of the priest. My family had managed to push the Harrison sisters all the way out to the other side of that taboo. Ma and Carmel had begged the uniforms not to take Da, the disgrace of it, and they had been sweet enough to oblige. For plenty of cops back then, domestic violence was like vandalizing your own property, a dumb idea, but probably not a crime. They had dragged Da up the stairs, dumped him on the kitchen floor, and left. Jackie said, "It was a bad one, all right." I said, "I figured that was what did it for Rosie. All her life, her dad's been warning her about what a share of filthy savages the Mackies are. She's ignored him, she's fallen in love with me, she's told herself I'm different. And then, right when she's a few hours away from putting her whole life into my hands, right when every minuscule doubt in her mind has to be 1,000 times its normal size, here come the Mackies to demonstrate Daddy's point in living colour, putting on a holy show for the entire neighbourhood, howling and brawling and biting and throwing shite like a troop of baboons on PCP. She had to wonder what I was like behind closed doors. She had to wonder if, deep down, I was one of them. She had to wonder just how long that would take to surface." "So you left? Even without her?" I said, "I figured I'd paid my way out." "I wondered about that. Why you didn't just come home?" "If I'd had the money, I'd have hopped straight in a plane to Australia. The farther, the better." Jackie asked, "Do you still blame them? Or was that just the drink talking last night?
Yeah, I said. I do, the whole lot of them.
That's probably unfair, but sometimes life can be just a big old bitch. My phone beeped. Text message.
Hi, Frank. Kev here. Not meaning to hassle you, 'cause I know you're a busy man. But when you get a chance, give us a bell, okay? Could do with a chat. Thanks.
I deleted it.
Jackie said, But what if she wasn't walking out on you after all? If that never happened?
I didn't have an answer for that one. A big part of my head didn't even understand the question. And it felt decades too late to go looking for one. I ignored Jackie till she shrugged and started refurbishing her lipstick. I watched Holly spin in great crazy circles as the swing chains untwisted, and I very carefully thought about exactly nothing except whether she needed to put on her scarf, how long it would be before she simmered down enough to be hungry, and what I wanted on my pizza. Chapter 10. We had our pizza. Jackie headed off to show Gavin some love, and Holly begged me into taking her to the Christmas ice rink in Ballsbridge. Holly skates like a fairy, and I skate like a gorilla with neurological issues, which of course is a bonus for her because she gets to laugh at me when I smack into walls. By the time I dropped her back at Olivia's, both of us were happily exhausted and a little high on all those tinned Christmas carols, and both of us were in a much better mood. The sight of us on the doorstep, sweaty and messy and grinning, even wrung a reluctant smile out of Liv. I headed into town and had a couple of pints with the lads. I went home, Twin Peaks had never looked prettier, and took out a few nests of zombies on the Xbox, and I went to sleep loving the thought of a nice, ordinary day's work so much that I thought I just might start off the next morning by snogging my office door. I was right to enjoy the normal world while I had it. Deep down, even while I was shaking my fist at the sky and vowing never to darken the cobbles of that hellhole again, I must have known the place was going to take that as a challenge. It hadn't given me permission to leave the building, and it was going to come looking for me. It was coming up to lunchtime on Monday, and I had just finished introducing my boy with the drug dealer situation to his brand new granny, when my office phone rang. Mackie, I said. Brian, our squad admin, said, Personal call for you. Do you want to take it? I wouldn't have hassled you, only it sounds, well, urgent, to say the least. Kevin again. It had to be. Still a clingy little bastard after all this time. One day of tagging along after me, and he thought he was my new bestest buddy, or my sidekick, or God only knew what. The sooner that got nipped in the bud, the better. What the hell, I said, rubbing the spot between my eyebrows that had suddenly started to throb. Put him through. Her, Brian said, and she's not a happy camper. I just thought I'd warn you. It was Jackie, and she was crying hard.
Francis, thank God, please, you've got to come. I don't understand. I don't know what happened. Please.
Her voice dissolved into a wail, a high, thin sound, way beyond anything like embarrassment or control. Something cold tightened at the back of my neck. Jackie, I snapped. Talk to me. What's going on? I could barely understand the answer. Something about the Hearns and the guards and the garden. Jackie, I know you're upset, but I need you to pull it together for me just for a second. Take a deep breath and tell me what's happened. She gasped for breath.
Kevin! Francis! Francis! God! It's Kevin!
That icy clamp again, tighter. I said, Is he hurt?
He's... Francis, oh God! He's dead! He's...
Where are you?
Maz, outside Maz.
Is that where Kevin is?
Yeah. No, not here. The back, the garden. He...
Her voice disintegrated again. She was sobbing and hyperventilating at the same time. I said, Jackie, listen to me. You need to sit down, drink something, and make sure there's someone looking after you. I'm on my way.
I already had my jacket half on. In undercover, nobody asks where you were this morning. I hung up and started running. And there I was again, back in Faithful Place, just like I'd never been away. The first time I got out, it had let me run for 22 years before it jerked the leash tight. The second time, it had given me 36 hours. The neighborhood was out again, like it had been on Saturday afternoon, but this time was different. The kids were in school and the adults were at work, so it was old people and stay-at-home mas and dole rats, wrapped tight against the slicing cold, and no one was milling about having a great day out. All the steps and all the windows were crammed with blank, watchful faces, but the street was empty except for my old friend the Bog Monster, marching up and down like he was guarding the Vatican. The uniforms had been a step ahead this time, herded everyone back before that dangerous buzz could start to build. Somewhere a baby was wailing, but apart from that there was a killer silence, nothing but the far-off hum of traffic, and the rap of the Bog Monster's shoe lifts, and the slow drip of the morning's rain coming off the gutters. No bureau van this time, no Cooper, but in between the uniforms marked car and the morgue van was Scorcher's pretty silver Beamer. The crime scene tape was back up around number 16, and a big guy in plain clothes, one of Scorcher's boys by the suit, was keeping an eye on it. Whatever had got Kevin, it wasn't a heart attack. The Bog Monster ignored me, which was a good choice. On the steps of number 8 were Jackie, my ma, and my da. Ma and Jackie were holding each other up. They looked like if either of them moved an inch, they would both crumple. Da was ferociously laying into a cigarette. Slowly, as I got close, their eyes focused on me, but without a flicker of recognition. They looked like they'd never seen me before. I said, "Jackie, what happened?" Da said, "You came back. That's what happened." Jackie grabbed the front of my jacket in a vice grip and pressed her face hard against my arm. I fought down the urge to shove her off me. "Jackie, pet," I said gently, "I need you to keep it together for me for just a little longer. Talk to me." She had started to shake. "Oh, Francis," she said, in a tiny, amazed voice.
"Oh, Francis, how?"
"I know, pet. Where is he?" Ma said grimly, "He's out the back of number 16. In the garden. Out in the rain all morning." She was leaning heavily on the railing, and her voice sounded thick and pinched, like she'd been sobbing for hours. But her eyes were sharp and dry. "Do you have any idea what happened?" Nobody said anything. Ma's mouth worked. "Okay," I said. "But we're 100% positive it's Kevin."
"Yeah, we are, you feckin' simpleton," Ma snapped.
She looked like she was seconds from hitting me across the face.
"D'you think I can't recognize my own child that I carried? Are you gooky in the head, are you?"
I thought about pushing her down the steps.
"Right," I said. "Well done. Is Carmel on her way?"
"Carmel's coming," Jackie said. "And Shay's coming. He just has to... He has to...
Her words dried up.
Da said, "He's waiting for the boss to come mind the shop."
He dropped a cigarette butt over the railing and watched it fizzle out by the basement window.
"Good,"
I said. There was no way I was leaving Jackie on her own with these two, but she and Carmel could look after each other. "There's no reason for you to wait out here in the cold. Get inside, get something hot into you, and I'll go see what I can find out." No one moved. I pried Jackie's fingers off my jacket as gently as I could, and left the three of them there. Dozens of unblinking pairs of eyes followed me back up the road to number 16. The big guy at the tape took one look at my ID and said, "Detective Kennedy's out the back. Straight down the stairs and out the door." He had been warned to expect me. The back door was propped open, letting an eerie grey slant of light into the basement and up the stairs. The four men in the garden looked like a tableau out of a painting or a morphine dream.
The heavy-set morgue boys in their pristine whites, leaning patiently on their stretcher among the tall weeds and the broken bottles and the nettles as thick as cables. Scorcher, sharp-edged and hyper-real, with his slick head bent and his black overcoat flapping against the worn brick of the wall, crouching to stretch out a gloved hand. And Kevin. He was on his back, with his head towards the house and his legs splayed out at the wrong angles. One arm was across his chest, the other was doubled underneath him, like someone had him in an armlock. His head was thrown back wildly and turned away from me, and there were big, uneven clots of something black matted in the dirt around it. Scorcher's white fingers were probing delicately in his jeans pocket. The wind whistled, a high, crazy sound, over the wall. Scorcher heard me first, or sensed me. He glanced up, whipped his hand away from Kevin, and straightened. "Frank," he said, coming towards me, "I'm so sorry for your loss." He was peeling his glove off, ready to shake my hand. I said, "I want to look at him." Scorcher nodded and stepped back out of my way. I knelt down in the dirt and the weeds, next to Kevin's body. Dying had caved his face in, under the cheekbones and around the mouth. He looked 40 years older than he would ever be. The upturned side of his face was ice white. The lower side, where the blood had settled, was mottled purple. There was a crusty thread of blood coming from his nose, and where his jaw had dropped, I could see that his front teeth were broken. His hair was limp and dark with rain. One eyelid drooped a little over a cloudy eye like a sly, stupid wink. It was like I'd been shoved under an enormous, battering waterfall, like the force of it was ripping my breath away. I said, "Cooper. We need Cooper. He's been here. And?" A tiny silence. I saw the morgue boys glance at each other. Then Scorcher said, "According to him, your brother died either from a fractured skull or from a broken neck."
"How?"
Scorcher said gently, "Frank, the lads need to take him away now. Come inside, we'll talk there. They'll take good care of him." He reached out a hand towards my elbow, but he had better sense than to touch me. I took one last look at Kevin's face, that vacant wink and the black trickle of blood, and the little twist to his eyebrow that used to be the first thing I saw every morning next to me on the pillow when I was 6 years old. Then I said, "Right." As I turned to leave, I heard the heavy ripping noise of the boys unzipping their body bag. I don't remember getting back into the house, or Scorcher guiding me up the stairs out of the morgue boys' way. Juvenile shite like punching walls wouldn't touch this. I was so angry that for a minute I thought I had gone blind. When my eyes cleared, we were on the top floor in one of the back rooms that Kevin and I had checked out on Saturday. The room was brighter and colder than I remembered. Someone had pushed up the bottom half of the filthy sash window, letting in a stream of icy light. Scorcher said, "Are you okay?" I needed, like a drowning man needs air, to hear him talk to me cop to cop, box in this howling mess with neat, flat, preliminary report words. I said, and my voice came out strange and tinny and distant, "What have we got?" Regardless of all the many things that may be wrong with him, Scorcher is one of ours. I saw him get it. He nodded and leaned back against the wall, settling in for this. "Your brother was last seen at around 11:20 last night. He, your sister Jacinta and your brother Seamus, your sister Carmel and her family, had dinner at your parents' place as per routine. Stop me if I'm telling you anything you already know." I shook my head. "Keep going." "Carmel and her husband took their children home around 8. The others stayed put for a while longer, watching television and talking. Everyone, except your mother, had a few cans over the course of the evening. General consensus is that the men were a little drunk, but definitely not blotto. and Jacinta only had the two. Kevin, Seamus, and Jacinta left your parents' place together just after 11. Seamus went upstairs to his flat, and Kevin walked Jacinta down Smith's Road as far as the corner of New Street, where her car was parked. She offered Kevin a lift, but he said he wanted to walk off the gargle. She assumed his plan was to head back the way they'd come, along Smith's Road, past the entrance to Faithful Place, then cut through the Liberties and along the canal to his flat in Portobello. But obviously, she can't verify that. He watched her into her car, then waved goodbye, and she drove off. The last she saw of him, he was turning back down Smith's Road. That's our last confirmed sighting of him alive. By 7, he had given up and stopped ringing me. I'd ignored him thoroughly enough that he hadn't thought it was worthwhile giving me one more try, before he tried to deal with whatever it was all by his great, gormless self. "Only he didn't go home," I said. "Doesn't look like it." The builders are next door today, so no one came in here till late this morning when two kids called Jason and Logan Hearn headed in to have a look at the basement, glanced out the landing window and got more than they bargained for. They're 13 and 12, and why they weren't in school? "Personally," I said, "I'm delighted they weren't." With number 14 and number 12 empty, nobody would have spotted Kevin from a back window. He could have stayed there for weeks. I've seen bodies after that long. Scorch gave me a quick, apologetic sideways glance. He'd got carried away. "Yeah," he said, "there is that." Anyway, they legged it out of there and called their mother, who called us and apparently half the neighbourhood. Miss Hearn also recognised the deceased as your brother, so she notified your mother, who made the definitive ID. I'm sorry she had to see that. I said, "My ma's tough." Behind me, somewhere downstairs, there was a thump, a grunt, and a scraping sound as the morgue boys manoeuvred their stretcher through the narrow corridors. I didn't turn around. Cooper puts time of death somewhere in the region of midnight, plus or minus a couple of hours either way. Add in your family's statements and the fact that your brother was found in the same clothes that they describe him wearing yesterday evening, and I think we can take it that after walking Jacinta to her car, he headed directly back to Faithful Place. And then what? How the fuck did he wind up with his neck broken? Scorch took a breath. "For whatever reason," he said, "your brother came into this house and upstairs to this room. Then, one way or another, he went out the window. If it's any comfort, Cooper says death was probably near instantaneous." Stars were exploding in front of my eyes, like I'd been bashed over the head. I raked a hand through my hair. "No, that doesn't make sense. Maybe he fell off the garden wall. One of the walls." For a confused second, I was seeing Kev, 16 and limber, vaulting his way across dark gardens in pursuit of Linda Dwyer's blouse bunnies. "Out of here makes no sense." Scorcher shook his head. "The walls on both sides are, what, 6 feet high? 7 tops? According to Cooper, the injuries say he fell around 20. And the trajectory was straight down. He went out this window." "No. Kevin didn't like this place. On Saturday I practically had to drag him in by the scruff of his neck. He spent the whole time moaning about rats and heebie-jeebies and the ceilings falling in. And that was in broad daylight, with the two of us there. What the hell would he be doing here on his own in the middle of the night?"
"We'd like to know the same thing. I wondered if he needed a piss before he headed home and came in for a bit of privacy, but then why come all the way up here? He could have hung his mickey out the hall floor window just as easily, if he was aiming to water the garden. I don't know about you, but when I'm a bit the worse for wear, I don't take on stairs without a reason."
That was when I realized that the smudges on the window frame weren't grime. They were print dust. And that was when it hit me why the sight of Scorcher had given me that nasty feeling. I said, "What are you doing here?" Scorch's eyelids flickered. He said, picking his words,
At first, we were thinking in terms of an accident. Your brother comes up here for whatever reason, and then something makes him stick his head out the window. Maybe he hears a noise in the back garden. Maybe the booze isn't sitting well and he thinks he's going to get sick. He leans out, overbalances, doesn't catch himself in time. Something cold hit the back of my throat. I clamped my teeth on it. But I did a bit of experimenting just to see for myself. Hamill downstairs, the guy at the tape, he's very near your brother's height and build. I've spent most of the morning making him hang out that window. It doesn't work, Frank. What are you talking about? On Hamill, that sash comes up to about here. Scorch put the side of his hand to his ribs. To get his head under it, he has to bend his knees, and that brings his backside down and keeps his center of gravity well inside the room. We tried it a dozen different ways, same result. It'd be almost impossible for someone Kevin's size to fall out that window by accident. The inside of my mouth felt icy. I said, "Somebody pushed him." Scorch hiked up his jacket to shove his hands in his pockets. He said carefully, "We've got no signs of a struggle, Frank." "What are you saying?" "If he'd been forced out that window, I'd expect to see scuffle marks on the floor, the window sash smashed away where he went through it, breakage to his fingernails from grabbing at the attacker or the window frame, maybe cuts and bruises where they fought. We haven't found any of that." I said, "You're trying to tell me Kevin killed himself?" That made Scorcher look away. He said, "I'm trying to tell you it wasn't an accident, and there's nothing that says he was pushed. According to Cooper, every one of his injuries is consistent with the fall. He was a big guy, and from what I've gathered, he may have been a bit drunk last night, but he wasn't legless. He wouldn't have gone down without a fight." I took a breath. "Right," I said. "Fair enough. You've got a point. Come here for a second, though. There's something I should probably show you." I guided him towards the window. He gave me a suspicious look. "What have you got?" "Take a good look at the garden from this angle, where it meets the base of the house, specifically. You'll see what I mean." He leaned on the sill and craned his neck out under the window sash. "Where?" I shoved him harder than I meant to. For a split second, I thought I wasn't going to be able to pull him back inside. Deep down, a sliver of me was fucking delighted. "Jesus Christ!" Scorch leaped back from the window and stared at me, wide-eyed. "Have you lost your fucking mind?" "No scuffle marks, Scorch. No broken window sash. No broken fingernails, no cuts and bruises. You're a big guy, you're stone-cold sober, and you'd have gone without a squeak. Bye-bye, thank you for playing. Scorcher has left the building." "Bloody hell!" He tugged his jacket straight and slapped dust off it, hard. "Not funny, Frank. You scared the shit out of me." "Good. Kevin was not the suicidal type, Scorch. You're gonna have to trust me on this one. There's no way he'd have taken himself out." "Fine. Then tell me this. Who was out to get him?" "Nobody that I know of, but that doesn't mean anything. He could have had the entire Sicilian mafia on his arse for all I know." Scorcher kept his mouth shut and let that speak for itself. I said, "So we weren't bosom buddies. I didn't have to live in his pocket to know he was a healthy young guy, no mental illness, no love life troubles, no money troubles, happy as Larry. And then one night, out of nowhere, he decides to wander into a derelict house and take a header out of the window." "It happens. Show me one piece of evidence that says it happened here. One." Scorch patted his hair back into place and sighed. "Okay," he said. "But I'm sharing this with you as a fellow cop, Frank, not as a family member of the Vic. You don't breathe a word of it outside this room. Are you okay with that?" "I'm just ducky," I said. I already knew this was going to be bad. Scorcher leaned over his puffy briefcase, fiddled around inside, and came up holding a clear plastic evidence bag. "Don't open it," he said.
It was one small sheet of lined paper, yellowish and quartered by deep creases, where it had spent a long time folded. It looked blank till I flipped it over and saw the faded ballpoint. And then, before my brain worked out what was happening, the handwriting came roaring up out of every dark corner and slammed into me like a runaway train. "Dear Mam and Dad and Nora, by the time you read this, I'll be on my way to England with Francis. We're going to get married. We're going to get good jobs, not in factories. And we're going to have a brilliant life together. The only thing I wish is that I wouldn't have had to lie to you. Every single day I wanted to look yous all in the eye and say I'm going to marry him. But, Dad, I didn't know what else to do. I knew you would go mental. But Frank is not a waster, and he is not going to hurt me. He makes me happy. This is the happiest day of my life."
"The lads at Documents will need to run some tests," Scorcher said. "But I'd say we've both seen the other half of that before." Outside the window, the sky was grey-white, turning icy. A cold swipe of air whipped in through the window, and a tiny swirl of dust specks rose from the floorboards, sparkled for a second in the weak light, then fell and vanished. Somewhere I heard the hiss and rattle of plaster disintegrating, trickling away. Scorcher was watching me with something that I hoped, for the sake of his health, wasn't sympathy. I said, "Where did you get this?" "It was in your brother's inside jacket pocket." Which rounded off this morning's set of 1, 2, 3 punches beautifully. When I got some air into my lungs, I said, "That doesn't tell you where he got it. It doesn't even tell you he was the one who put it there." "No," Scorcher agreed, too mildly. "It doesn't." There was a silence. Scorch waited a tactful amount of time before he held out his hand for the evidence bag. I said, "You're thinking this means Kevin killed Rosie." "I'm not thinking anything. At this stage, I'm just collecting the evidence." He reached for the bag. I whipped it away. "You keep collecting. Do you hear me? I'm going to need that back. Innocent until proven guilty, Kennedy. This is a long, long way from proof. Remember that." "Hmm," Scorch said neutrally. "The other thing I'm going to need is you keeping out of my way, Frank. I'm very serious." "There's a coincidence. So am I. Before was bad enough. But now... it doesn't get much more emotion involved than this. I realize you're upset, but any interference from you could compromise my whole investigation, and I won't allow that." I said, "Kevin didn't kill anyone. Not himself, not Rosie, not anyone. You just keep collecting that evidence." Scorcher's eyes flickered away from mine. After a moment, I gave him his precious Ziploc and left. As I went through the door, Scorcher said, "Hey, Frank, at least now we know for a fact she wasn't planning on leaving you." I didn't turn around. I could still feel the heat of her writing, reaching right through Scorcher's prissy little label to wrap round my hand, searing me to the bones. "This is the happiest day of my life." She had been coming to me, and she'd almost made it. There had been about 10 yards between us and our hand-in-hand brave new world. It felt like free-falling, like being shoved out of a plane with the ground rushing up hard towards me and no parachute cord to pull. Chapter 11 I opened the front door a crack and closed it loudly for Scorcher's benefit. Then I went down the back stairs, out to the garden, and over the wall. I didn't have time to deal with my family. Word spreads fast on the job, especially when the gossip is this juicy. I switched my mobiles off and headed for the squad, fast, to tell my super I was taking some time off before he could tell me the same thing. George is a big guy, pushing retirement, with a droopy, exhausted face like a toy Basset hound's. We love him. Suspects make the mistake of thinking they can love him too. "Ah," he said, heaving himself out of his chair when he saw me at the door.
Frank. He held out his hand across the desk. I'm sorry for your loss. We weren't close, I said, giving him a good, firm grip. But it's a shock, all right.
They're saying it looks like he might have done it himself.
Yep, I agreed, watching the sharp, assessing flash in his eye as he sank back into his chair. They are. It's a head wrecker all round. Boss, I've got a lot of holiday time saved up. If it's all right with you, I'd like to cash it in, effective immediately. George passed a hand over his bald spot and examined it mournfully, pretending to consider that.
Can your investigations afford it?
Not a problem, I said, which he already knew. Reading upside down is one of life's more useful skills, and the file in front of him was one of mine. Nothing's at a crucial stage. They just need watching. An hour or two to get my paperwork in shape, and I can be ready to hand over.
Right, George said on a sigh. Why not?
Hand over to Yates. He's having to ease off on the Southside coke op for a while. He's got time. Yates is good. We don't have duds in undercover.
I'll bring him up to speed, I said.
Thanks, boss.
Take a few weeks. Clear the head.
What'll you do? Spend time with the family?
In other words, are you planning to hang around the scene asking awkward questions?
I said, I was thinking about getting out of town. Wexford, maybe. I hear the coastline's lovely this time of year.
George massaged his forehead folds like they hurt.
Some gobshite from murder was onto me bright and early this morning, giving out about you. Kennedy, Kenny, whatever. Says you've been interfering with his investigation.
The squealing little arse gerbil.
He's PMSing, I said. I'll bring him some pretty flowers and he'll be grand.
Bring him whatever you want. Just don't be bringing him any excuse to ring me again. I don't like gobshites annoying me before I've had my cup of tea. Banjax's my bowels.
I'll be in Wexford, boss, remember. I won't have the opportunity to get Little Miss Murder's frillies in a twist, even if I wanted to. I'll just tidy up a few things. I jerked a thumb in the direction of my office, and I'll be on my way out of everyone's hair.
George inspected me under heavy lids. Eventually he flapped a big, weary hand and said, "Tidy away, take your time."
"Cheers, boss," I said. This is why we love George. One of the things that makes a great super is knowing when he doesn't want to know. "I'll see you in a few weeks." I was halfway out the door when he called, "Frank?"
"Boss?"
"Anywhere the squad can make a donation, in your brother's name. Charity, sports club." And it hit me all over again, like a rabbit punch straight to the gullet. For a second, nothing came out of my mouth. I didn't even know if Kev had been in a sports club, although I doubted it. I thought there should be a charity created specially with fucked-up situations like this one in mind, a fund to send young guys snorkeling round the Great Barrier Reef and paragliding down the Grand Canyon, just in case that day turned out to be their last chance. "Give it to the victims of homicide crowd," I said.
"And thank you, boss. I appreciate it.
Tell the lads thanks."
Deep down in his heart, every undercover believes that, by and large, murder are a bunch of big pussy boys. There are exceptions, but the fact is that the murder lads are our pro boxers. They fight hard. But when you come right down to it, they have gloves and gum shields, and a referee ringing his little bell when everyone needs to take a breather and wipe off the blood. Undercovers fight bare knuckle. We fight backstreet, and we fight till someone goes down. If Scorch wants into a suspect's house, he fills in a square mile of paperwork and waits for the rubber stamps and assembles the appropriate entry team so no one gets hurt. Me? I bat the baby blues, spin a good story, and waltz right in. And if the suspect should decide he wants to kick the shit out of me, I'm on my own. This was about to work for me. Scorch was used to fighting by the rules. He took it for granted that, with the odd, minor, bad little boy breach, I fought the same way. It would take a while to occur to him that my rules had sweet fuck-all in common with his. I spread out a bunch of files on my desk, in case anyone happened to stop by and needed to see me busy working towards a handover. Then, I phoned my mate in records and asked him to email me the personnel file of every floater working on the Rose Daily murder. He did a little fussing about confidentiality, but a couple of years back, his daughter had got off on possession charges when someone was sloppy enough to misfile 3 wraps of coke and her statement sheet, so I figured he owed me at least 2 major or 4 minor favours. Underneath the fussing, he saw it the same way. His voice sounded like his ulcer was growing by the moment, but the files came through almost before we got off the phone. Scorcher had himself 5 floaters, more than I would have expected for a stone-cold case. Apparently, he and his 80-whatever% really did get props with the murder boys. The 4th floater was the one I needed. Stephen Moran. 26 years old, home address in the North Wall, good leaving cert results, straight from school into Temple Moor, string of glowing evaluations, out of uniform just 3 months. The photo showed a skinny kid with scruffy red hair and alert grey eyes. A working-class Dublin boy, smart and determined and on the fast track and, thank heaven for little newbies, way too green and too eager to question anything a squad detective might happen to tell him. Young Stephen and I were going to get along just fine. I tucked Stephen's details into my pocket, deleted the email very thoroughly, and spent a couple of hours getting my cases good and ready for Yates. The last thing I wanted was him ringing me at the wrong moment to clarify something or other. We did a nice quick handover. Yates had too much sense to give me any sympathy, beyond a slap on the shoulder and a promise that he'd take care of everything. Then I packed up my stuff, closed my office door, and headed over to Dublin Castle, where Murder Squad works, to annex Stephen Moran. If someone else had been running the investigation, Stephen might have been harder to find. He could have finished up at 6 or 7 or 8, and if he was out in the field, he might not have bothered to check back in at the squad and hand in his paperwork before he headed home. But I know Scorcher. Overtime gives the brass palpitations, and paper gives them orgasms, so Scorchy's boys and girls would clock out at 5 on the dot, and they would fill out all their forms before they did. I found myself a bench in the castle gardens with a good view of the door, and a nice anti-scorch screen of bushes, lit a smoke, and waited. It wasn't even raining. This was my lucky day all over. One thing in particular was slapped straight across the front of my mind. Kevin hadn't had a torch on him. If he had, Scorcher would have mentioned it to back up his little suicide theory. And Kevin never did dangerous shit unless he had a damn good reason. He left the because-it's-there stuff to me and Shay. There wasn't enough tinned Guinness in all of Dublin to make him think it would be fun to go wandering around number 16 on his own, in pitch darkness, just for kicks and giggles. Either he had seen or heard something on his way past that made him think he had no choice except to go and investigate, something too urgent to let him go get backup, but discreet enough that no one else on the road had noticed a thing, or someone had called him in there. Someone who had magically known that he would be passing the top of Faithful Place right about then. Or he had been bullshitting Jackie. He had been heading out to that house all along to meet someone who would come prepared. It was dark, and I'd built up a nice little pile of cigarette butts by my feet, before, sure enough, at 5 on the dot, Scorcher and his sidekick came out of that door and headed for the car park. Scorcher had his head up and a spring in his step, and he was swinging his briefcase and telling some story that made the ferret-faced kid laugh dutifully. Almost before they were gone, out came my boy Stephen, trying to wrangle a mobile and a knapsack and a bicycle helmet and a long scarf. He was taller than I had expected, and his voice was deeper, with a rough edge that made him sound younger than he was. He was wearing a grey overcoat that was very good quality and very, very new. He had blown his savings to make sure he would fit in with the murder boys. The nice thing was that I had a free hand here. Stephen might have his doubts about getting chatty with the victim's brother, but I was willing to bet that he hadn't actually been warned off me. Cooper was one thing, but Scorch would never in a million years have told an itty-bitty floater that he was feeling threatened by little old me. Scorcher's overdeveloped sense of hierarchy was, in fact, about to come in useful all round. In his personal world, uniforms are scut monkeys, floaters are droids, only squad detectives and up get any respect. That attitude is always a very bad idea, not only because of how much you might be wasting, but because of how many weak spots you're creating for yourself. Like I said before, I've always had a lovely eye for a weak spot. Stephen hung up and stashed his mobile in a pocket, and I threw my smoke away and stepped out of the gardens into his path. Stephen? Yeah? Frank Mackey, I said, putting out my hand. Undercover. I saw his eyes widen just a touch, with what could have been awe or fear or anything in between. Over the years, I've planted and watered a number of interesting legends about myself, some of them true, some of them not, all of them useful, so I get that a lot. Stephen at least made a decent stab at keeping it under wraps, which I approved of. Stephen Moran, General Unit, he said, shaking my hand just a little too firmly and holding the eye contact just a little too long. The kid was working hard to impress me. It's good to meet you, sir. Call me Frank. We don't, sir, in undercover. I've been keeping an eye on you for a while now, Stephen. We've been hearing a lot of very nice things. He managed to hold back both the blush and the curiosity. That's always good to know. I was starting to like this kid. I said, walk with me, and headed back into the gardens. There were going to be more floaters and more murder boys coming out of that building. Tell me something, Stephen. You made detective 3 months ago, am I right? He walked like a teenager, that long, springy stride when you have too much energy to fit in your body. That's right. Well done. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see you as the type to spend the rest of your career in the general unit, tagging along after whatever squad detective snaps his fingers this week. You've got too much potential for that. You'll want to run investigations of your own eventually, am I right? That's the plan. Which squad are you aiming for? This time, a little bit of the blush made it through. Murder, or undercover. You've got good taste, I said, grinning. So working a murder case must be a dream come true, yeah? Having fun? Stephen said cautiously, I am learning a lot. I laughed out loud. You are in your arse. That means Scorcher Kennedy's been treating you like his very own trained chimpanzee. What's he got you doing, making coffee? Picking up his dry cleaning? Mending his socks? One corner of Stephen's mouth twitched reluctantly. Typing up witness statements. Oh, lovely. How many words per minute can you do? I don't mind. I mean, I'm the newest, you know. All the others have a few years under their belts, and someone has to do the... He was struggling valiantly to get it right. Stephen, I said, breathe. This isn't a test. You're wasted on secretarial work. You know that, I know that, and if Scorch had bothered to take 10 minutes to read your file, he'd know it too. I pointed to a bench under a lamppost so I could watch his face and out of view of any of the main exits. Have a seat. Stephen slung his knapsack and helmet on the ground and sat down. In spite of the flattery, his eyes were wary, which was good. We're both busy men, I said, joining him on the bench, so I'll cut to the chase. I'd be interested in hearing how you get on in this investigation. From your perspective, not from Detective Kennedy's, since we both know just how much use his would be. No need to be diplomatic, we're talking strictly confidential just between the two of us. I could see his mind moving fast. But he had a decent poker face, and I couldn't pick out which way it was taking him. He said, "Hearing how I get on." "What do you mean by that, exactly?" "We meet up now and then. Maybe I buy you a nice pint or two. You tell me what you've been at the last few days, what you think about it, how you'd be handling the case differently if you were the boss man. I see what I think of how you work. How does that strike you?" Stephen picked a stray dead leaf off the bench and started folding it carefully along the veins.
Can I talk to you straight, like we're off duty, man to man? I spread my hands. We are off duty, Stephen, my friend. Hadn't you noticed? I mean, I know what you mean. At ease, mate. Say whatever springs to mind, no repercussions. His eyes came up from the leaf to meet mine, level and grey and intelligent. Word is, you've got a personal interest in this case. A double interest, now. That's hardly a state secret. And?
What it sounds like to me, Stephen said, is you want me to spy on this murder investigation and report back to you.
I said cheerfully, if that's how you want to look at it.
I'm not mad about the sound of that.
Interesting. I found my cigarettes. Smoke?
No, thanks.
Not as green as he had looked on paper. No matter how badly the kid wanted to be in my good books, he was nobody's bitch. Normally I would have approved of this, but right that minute I wasn't in the mood for doing dainty footwork around his stubborn side. I lit up and blew smoke rings into the smudgy yellow light of the lamp.
Stephen, I said, you need to think this through. I presume you're worried about three aspects of this. The level of commitment involved, the ethics, and the potential consequences, not necessarily in that order, am I right?
More or less, yeah.
Let's start with the commitment. I won't be asking you for in-depth daily reports on everything that goes on in that squadron. I'll be asking you very specific questions that you'll be able to answer with a minimum expenditure of time and effort. We're talking two or three meetings a week, none of which need to last more than 15 minutes if you've got something better to do, plus maybe another half hour's worth of research before each meeting. Does that sound like something you could manage, just hypothetically speaking?
After a moment, Stephen nodded.
It's not about having better things to do. Good man. Next, possible consequences. Yes, Detective Kennedy would quite probably have the mother of all hissy fits if he found out you and I were talking. But there's no reason why he should. It ought to be obvious to you that I'm very, very good at keeping my mouth shut. How about you?
I'm not a squealer.
I didn't think so. In other words, the risk of Detective Kennedy catching you and sending you to the naughty corner is minimal. And Stephen, keep in mind that's not the only possible consequence here. Plenty of other things could come out of this.
I waited till he asked,
like what?
When I said you had potential, I wasn't just blowing smoke up your arse.
Remember, this case won't last forever. And as soon as it ends, you go back to the floater pool. Looking forward to that?
He shrugged. It's the only way onto a squad. It needs doing.
Following up on stolen cars and broken windows, and waiting for someone like Scorcher Kennedy to whistle for you so you can fetch his sandwiches for a few weeks? Sure, it needs doing. But some people do it for a year, and some people do it for 20. Given the choice, when would you, personally, want to get out of there for good?
The sooner the better, obviously.
That's what I thought. I guarantee you, I will in fact be noticing exactly how you work, just like I said I would. And every time a place opens up on my squad, I remember people who've done good work for me. I can't guarantee the same for my friend Scorcher. Tell me something, just between the two of us. Does he even know your first name?
Stephen didn't answer.
So, I said, I think that takes care of potential consequences, don't you? Which leaves us with the ethics of the situation. Am I asking you to do anything that might compromise your work on the murder case?
Not so far.
And I don't plan to. If at any point you feel that our association is jeopardizing your ability to give your full attention to your official assignment, just let me know and you won't hear from me again. You've got my word on that.
Always, always give them a free out that they'll never have a chance to use.
Fair enough.
He didn't look reassured.
Yeah. Am I asking you to disobey anyone else's orders?
That's splitting hairs.
Okay, Detective Kennedy hasn't told me not to talk to you, but that's only because it hasn't even occurred to him that I might.
So? It should have occurred to him.
If it hasn't, that's his problem, not yours or mine. You don't owe him anything. Stephen ran a hand through his